Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. Human Rights Watch recently released a report on police abuses in Uzbekistan at the start of July when there were protests in the Republic of Karakalpakstan over proposed changes to the Uzbek constitution that would have stripped Karakalpakstan of its constitutional recognition as a sovereign administrative entity. Violence broke out when police moved to disperse the protesters, and at least 21 people were killed. More than 500 were arrested. Uzbek authorities created what they called an independent commission to investigate the incident, but the commission has not released much information more than 4 months after it started its work. But what's happening with the investigation? And what does Uzbekistan's history tell us about investigations and the treatment of ethnic minorities? To discuss all this, I am joined by Mira Rietman, a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, and Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer who has spent many years focusing on Central Asia and is currently an associate professor at the University of Southern California. Thank you both for joining me. And I also want to mention that we did try to have someone from Karakalpakstan on the program, but unfortunately that was not possible for this program. But we will have representatives of the Karakalpak community on the show in the near future. Steve, you know, if I could start with you, and I always put you on the hot seat, I know this, but can you give us a very brief summary of the background of what led to the protests in Karakalpakstan?
Sure. Well, the government somewhat haphazardly announced that there would be a process of a new constitution being introduced, and that the draft amendments that were released in late June, I believe, omitted references to Karakalpakstan's sovereign status. They omitted, basically deleted a provision that allows for, by process of referendum, for the Autonomous Republic of Karakalpakstan to secede or remove itself from the Republic of Uzbekistan. Again, that sort of conjures up the complicated interrelationship in a way between Karakalpakstan and Uzbekistan, or Karakalpakstan's status, which since 1993 has been considered a sovereign republic within the Republic of Uzbekistan. So the removal of these provisions, which weren't discussed with the population broadly in Karakalpakstan or in general in Uzbekistan, immediately led to questions. There were petitions being circulated, requests from activists, lawyers, journalists in Karakalpakstan to discuss these things. And there were announcements made by various activists to hold peaceful protests early in July, July 5th, I believe. And pretty quickly, the Uzbek authorities moved in and detained some of the key activists that had proposed these protests. And that led to protests on July 1st and July 2nd, which then really ballooned very quickly into thousands of people protesting peacefully on the streets in Karakalpakstan, Nukus, the capital of Karakalpakstan, but also in other cities. And shortly thereafter, authorities used lethal force, which is really expertly laid out in the recent report from Human Rights Watch. And we saw lethal force used officially. The figures were that 21 people died, 243, I believe, injured, and many more detained. Some independent NGOs, or I should say other groups that have conducted investigations, like Vitaly Ponomariov from Memorial, put the death toll a little bit higher, perhaps closer to 40. We don't quite know. There hasn't been an opportunity, of course, we're going to talk about that, to investigate on the ground in that way. But at least we know 21 deaths. That includes, I think, 4 police officers. And to date, the government, which we'll also discuss, has announced this parliamentary commission and also its own investigations from the prosecutor general's office. There hasn't been much disclosed about the investigation beyond releases of some of the people suspected of being involved in what they call mass rioting. So we don't know of any police officers actually to date that have been detained. We don't know much at all really about the official version of events. The government says the investigation is still ongoing. It hasn't been completed, and they won't release that information until it's completed. So we're really in a sort of moment of limbo or suspended animation, waiting to hear what the results of this official investigation, or I should say the two investigations, turn out to be. So it's been a moment where the country was plunged into unprecedented protests, probably the largest in its history. These may have actually been larger than the Andijan protests of 2005. And I should also mention that President Mirzoyev quickly climbed down from those proposed amendments or proposed changes and said that there would be no, that provision would not be deleted from the new constitution. But we don't know. In fact, we're coming up pretty soon on Constitution Day in December. And there was some discussion that the constitutional changes would actually be introduced by now, that there would be this referendum, but that hasn't happened. So we're sort of waiting to see what comes next.
Great. Thank you. Okay. And that brings me, Mira, you know, Steve mentioned that the police really don't seem to have figured in the very little bit of information that we have about this investigation. The police don't seem to have figured very largely. Actually, I don't even remember them being mentioned at all in any of the information they had. You know, images that we got in the hours after the violence started and in the days after it ended showed some serious wounds. I know this is the subject of your report, is actually what the police actions were. So could you explain, you know, Steve already started by saying these were peaceful protests that broke out. Now, what happened? Can you take us into what happened when the police decided they were going to resort to more aggressive tactics to disperse the crowd?
Hello, I'm very sorry about that. I don't know.
This kind of stuff happens when you're connecting with Central Asia. Okay, you know, you were just telling us that when they were using these grenades and stun grenades and flash grenades and stuff, that the video that you had been reviewing, at least a lot of it, showed that those protesters really didn't represent a threat to the life or health of law mm-hmm. enforcement officers. Can you pick
the law enforcement? Okay, so I'll jump back into what I was saying there. I went on to say that we documented the use of heavy projected grenades, which is a type of grenade that's about 10 times the weight of those stun grenades or flash grenades that I spoke about earlier. One man killed during the Karakalpak protests appears to have been hit in the chest with this type of grenade. We found one person whose wound that we saw in the video and photograph material that we had appears consistent with a gunshot injury. You know, the authorities, Uzbek authorities, have denied that they used live fire, but you know that's contradicted by the evidence that we have. We also saw that Uzbek security forces were equipped with Kalashnikov pattern rifles during the protests. We identified seven cases in which people sustained and probably died from severe tissue damage that was consistent with trauma caused by explosives. So again, the sort of impact with the body that causes sort of penetrating lacerations and can also cause the loss of large portions of flesh. You referenced some of these horrific images that were circulating around the time and somewhat after also, because at the time there was an internet blockage in Karakal, Pakistan, and it was actually very difficult to get information out of Uzbekistan, or in this case Karakal, Pakistan, about what was going on because of that blockage. So in total, we found 38 protesters who had either been killed, wounded, or beaten during the July protests. And this use of, you know, the inappropriate use of small arms and lethal weapons that contributed to the death of these 21 people that have been registered, and the many, many that were wounded, some who sustained very serious injuries.
Thank you very much. My next question, and Vera, I'll ask you this first. Well, I'll ask you, and then I'll get to Steve with another question. But can you tell me a little bit about who is on this commission that is investigating what happened on July 1st and July 2nd in Karakal, Pakistan?
Sure. The commission was set up on July 15th, so about 2 weeks after the events themselves. And, you know, it was an important step by authorities to set up a commission that was tasked with looking at human rights violations. And it included the involvement of two civil society representatives. It's there's also senators and other government officials, and it's headed by the Uzbekistan Ombudswoman Feruza Eshmatova. But you know, it's there are also significant problems with it. There's not a lot of transparency about its mandate, the scope of its investigation. It's not clear if they're looking into the matters of deaths and severe injuries that occurred or the actions taken by security forces. They've said that they're going to produce a report, but we don't know the timeline for their investigation and when that report is likely to be published, or in fact, then what will be done with the findings in that report, if that's going to lead to prosecutions, if that's actionable information or not. So there are still serious concerns about the independence of this commission, especially given the members of the commission and their position in government, a lot of them. And so there's still, you know, one of our recommendations to come out of our report is to call for an independent investigation, and one that's not tasked with the vague sort of approach of looking at human rights violations, but one that is going to set out a record of what happened with a view of holding those responsible for, the actions that led to the 21 deaths and those serious injuries that we documented, we know about. And so we hope that call, others have made a call for independent investigation. The U.S. government has made that call. The European Union has made that call. The Office of the High Commission for Human Rights has made a call for an independent investigation. And, you know, we've said this before, but it's consistent to do so with Uzbekistan's stated, you know, commitment to human rights and it's indeed its obligations under international human rights law to hold perpetrators of these sorts of crimes accountable. So the commission is, you know, it's the work of its commission is ongoing, but, you know, there's still a lot of questions about what will come of that investigation.
Great. Thank you. Steve, one, I want you to comment a little bit about what the commission has revealed to us since they started their work. But I also was wondering if you could comment a little bit about Mr. Tajimuratov and Lola Gul Kalihanova.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I agree completely with everything Mira just said about the problematic nature of the parliamentary commission, and members of Uzbek's independent civil society have commented since the start of this, that they're not comfortable. There's an illegitimacy about this process in the sense that you have one of the politicians on the commission who's probably the most outspoken member of the commission, Alisher Kadyrov, known often for making quite boisterous populist statements, said very early on that we don't believe in the sovereign status of Karakalpakstan to begin with, which I think really injected, certainly for many Karakalpaks, a sense that this was not going to be, that this was somewhat politicized. So it baffled me as to why he would be included alongside some of the other people. And of course, you have other members like the regional ombudsman representative from Karakalpakstan, who works for the national ombudswoman, Feruza Ishmatova. Of course, so it's good that you have some Karakalpak voices, but you don't have independent society activists like Azimbay Atanyazov. He was recently interviewed by the Voice of America, by Nabahore Mamova, when she was there in Karakalpakstan. And he said very clearly, why is the government so reluctant to invite independent and international experts? We have issues. We know that these deaths were violent. These protests were there for all to see. And it requires an open, difficult conversation between society and the government. And I thought his very clear-eyed advice is something we need to listen to, and one hopes that the government would do that. You asked me about what has been revealed and what they've done. Well, they did have a hand in interviewing many of the witnesses and some of the people detained, and it's still a little bit unclear to me the relationship between the Prosecutor General's office and the Parliamentary Commission and who makes what decisions, but at least we know from social media that the Parliamentary Commission and Ms. Ishmatova were involved in the release, at least to home arrest, of around 100 people. I also know that some of the members of the commission were able to interview the alleged ringleader, as they call him, Daulet Tajimuratov, the journalist, one of the people that initially called for peaceful meetings, peaceful demonstrations about the constitutional amendments. They met with him, but again, troublingly, what they showed on social media was a picture from behind showing the back of his head, speaking with the commission members. Now, some of them have said in conversations that they believe that actually the Western community, the international community, is somehow mischaracterizing the intentions of some of the protesters, including Taji Muratov, sort of saying that he's not as much of an angel as you and the human rights community like to say. So I've been, again, what it does is it raises a lot of questions about the process. The other thing is, even though it's certainly good that some of these people have been released, we don't know the final status, whether or not they're still facing charges. I believe some of them are. And so therefore, there's a lot of due process considerations. If you're going to tweet, if you're going to post photographs of meetings with defendants, well, then why is there such a deafening silence about the police officers that they are should be investigating for their use of excessive force? I think that imbalance has really come through. And it undermines the claims that we hear that they're waiting to weigh in until the completion of the investigation. Obviously, this is a very strategic deployment of social media. Bruce, what was the other question
I was just wondering about, you know, the fate of, well, you've talked a little bit about Nawlat.
Oh, yes. Let me just mention that relatives of Taji Muratov have been speaking out, voicing a lot of concern, despite the fact that we know now that he's met with the commission. We still don't know very much about his conditions. There were serious concerns raised about torture, trials closed. We still don't know much about the allegations, although the prosecutor general's office made an announcement that they're applying extremism charges or anti-constitutional activity, or more precisely, attempts to overthrow the constitutional order of Uzbekistan in regards to him. I believe that those charges have been mentioned in relation to Laligul Khalikhanova, a journalist who we don't precisely know. We don't know her whereabouts. And I think that's also very troubling. And her case was raised, for example, very early on by the Committee to Protect Journalists. So it's concerning. We don't know the fate and the conditions. And I think the government now, enough time has passed that there are some real concerns. And I'm personally also very troubled by the use of those specific charges, because, again, it conjures up a legacy that we know well from Uzbekistan's history, where terrorism and extremism charges are used to silence critics or perceived critics of the government. And that's something that should have changed by now.
Mira, do you want to add anything to that before we hit the halfway point?
Yeah, if we could pick up just on what Steve has been saying and alluding to, is just a real lack of transparency about where things stand with respect to the authorities' investigation as well as the commission's investigation. So very early on, I think it was July 4th, the prosecutor general's office announced that 516 people had been arrested. As Steve said, we know that over 100, I think it's 107, have been released, but there has been no formal announcement on the part of the authorities as to the status of these other people. Are they still in detention? Have they been released? Are they facing charges? And that lack of information is very unsettling. You know, there was the events were very consequential and people died, and the lack of information flow about the actions of authorities to hold people accountable for that loss of life and those serious injuries is, you know, we would want more from Uzbekistan in a situation like this. And I think, you know, we can also say that with respect to the commission that, you know, there has been strategic use of social media, but overall, there is a lack of transparency about its actions and the outcome. And I think that it would be great if, you know, there would be a very clear update, you know, even releasing the names of the people who died. We still don't know the names of the people who died. So without that information, it's just so many questions and so much uncertainty. And that is not to the authorities' benefit here. That does not play, you know, it just to the contrary, it undermines whatever it is that they're trying to do here. And it would be very, you know, it'd be worthwhile to take a moment and actually report back to the people who were affected, who are looking for accountability, who are looking for answers on the status of the investigation, including whether indeed any security officers are being investigated for the loss of life.
Thank you. And we have reached the halfway point of the discussion, so it's time for me to remind that this is the Mejlis podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. And I'm Bruce Bonier, the host of the show. And our topic today is the recent report released by Human Rights Watch on the violence in Qoraqalpakstan last July. And more broadly, the Uzbek government's history of treatment of ethnic minorities and what their previous investigations of violent acts of violence were like. Joining me for this discussion are Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer who has spent many years focusing on Central Asia and is currently an associate professor at the University of Southern California, Mira Rietman, a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. Thank you both again for being on the program. And let's look at some of the past and take a look at some of the history of some of this stuff. I know you both have been following Uzbekistan for a long time. Mira, actually, I'll start with you. This is supposed to be new Yangi Uzbekistan, right? New Uzbekistan. We have Mirziyoyev as president. He's made all these promises that business was going to be, everything was going to be different in Uzbekistan than it was under his predecessor. Have you noticed anything different about this investigation that you didn't see in previous investigations of alleged religious extremists or, you know, even we'll get to Andijan in a minute too. But what is this? Is this investigation different than the ones you remember from the Karimov era?
Well, I think it is important to recognize that there were, so yes, to some degree, indeed, there are notable differences. There were journalists on the ground quite soon after the events took place. Joanna Lillis, who we know, was there in the days after and was able to report from Nukus. I think that's important to recognize. There was the creation of this commission that was tasked with looking at human rights violations. I don't recall that such a commission was ever formed in the past to look at a situation where there was such serious, or let's say specifically with respect to Andijan. And there was backtracking, right, quite quickly in terms of what set off the grievances and led to the protests. So, you know, tacit acknowledgement that there was some missteps. We saw President Mirziyoyev on, I think, July 4th, say publicly that, you know, if there were illegal actions on the part of law enforcement, that they should be analyzed. And if they used force incorrectly, they should be held criminally liable. So, you know, those statements are very important to hear. And what remains to be seen now is if any of these developments or incidents that I described in terms of being a little bit more open or cognizant of the human rights violations took place are going to lead to any accountability in the end. And that's where we have yet to see meaningful actions on the part of the authorities. So right now there have been some initial steps. There's been some rhetoric that is important to hear, but now we need to give meaning to that rhetoric, and we need to see the outcome of this commission's work to see whether or not that's going to lead to security forces in particular being held accountable if there's going to be an investigation into any allegations of ill treatment and torture. And in that regard, there isn't, you know, so far we haven't seen anything that is very reassuring that we'll see that kind of outcome.
Okay, thank you. Steve, you know, obviously you've been watching Uzbekistan for a long time. Do you, as far as due process, access to lawyers, courtroom hearings, you know, that we're told anyway by this commission that everyone has access to a lawyer. But we don't actually get to speak with any of the lawyers, or I haven't seen any comments from any of these lawyers, and certainly not the defendants. And we see the trial processes are going on, but we don't know anything about them. Is that familiar?
Is it familiar? Oh, yes. I think yes, that's always been a problem with a lot of politically motivated trials in Uzbekistan. There's a phrase called pocket lawyers, karmanli advokaty in Russian, which means, you know, defense lawyers that are basically stand-ins or have been, you know, instructed by authorities not to rock the boat and to basically go along with the charges that are brought against defendants. I think that's a real concern. Of course, we know that, again, 6 years into the reform process, I was just on a recent conversation with leading members of the legal profession who said that for, you know, unexplained reasons, many of these common sense proposals to inject more freedom and more transparency into the independent bar have been stalled. There have been, you know, pending proposals to reform the code of the legal profession or the law on advocacy for a long time, which haven't been brought through to fruition. And that's kind of the story on several pieces of the reform agenda when it comes to NGOs, when it comes to many areas we can get into. But I think when it comes to due process, that's a core concern. And again, as I mentioned, the use of those charges, Article 159, Article 244, these are charges we know so well. The reason we know them so well is because the previous president, who in power for 27 years, Islam Karimov, used them basically from the moment he became president. It became really part of the DNA. It became almost a central guiding principle of governance, was to silence criticism in this way. And we still know that there are a large number of people in Uzbekistan's prisons. We don't know exactly how many. We did a recent report about this at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom just last year. And so adding to that group, a new group of Karakalpakstan cases, I think, again, is troubling. It's not the direction that we'd like to see this go in. There should be an open conversation. It's good that there's a parliamentary commission. And I think it's great that Mira found that statement from July 4th that the president made, which also heartened me at the time. I thought, this is different. This is different than 2005 in Andijan. But unfortunately, the rhetoric since that time has been more in the direction, and again, I'm referencing again the on-the-ground reporting that Nabuhori Mamava did recently when she met with Karakalpak officials, was this constant rhetoric that this was all caused by external forces, this was caused by Karakalpaks abroad and most directly in Kazakhstan. And that is exactly the type of rhetoric that we heard also at the time of Andijan, which I think is just an old, tired, and evidence-free claim.
Okay, thank you for that. And you mentioned the Karakalpaks in Kazakhstan. Mira, at the moment anyway, you're in Kazakhstan. Can you tell us a little bit about the Karakalpaks that have been detained in Kazakhstan?
Yeah, I can't remember the most recent arrest, but starting in mid-September, five diaspora Karakalpaks have been arrested in Almaty. The last one who was arrested, Tulebek Yuldasheva, I can't remember exactly where she was arrested. Do you recall, Bruce?
It was up on the Russian-Kazakh border.
It was on the border. Okay. So all of them, as far as we know, are wanted in, it seems to be in connection with the Karakalpakstan events for alleged offenses against the state. There's Koshkabay Toremuratov, who's a dissident blogger. There's Zhangeldi Jaksimbetov, who's an opposition figure. They were the first two to be picked up. Then there was Raisa Hudaybergenova, who's a cardiologist. She was detained at her workplace a couple of days after that. And then the fourth in that time frame, Ziyar Mirmanbetova, was another activist who was detained in her home. To one degree or another, all of these individuals have spoken out about Karakalpakstan and in particular about voiced concerns about the proposed constitutional changes. So Kazakh authorities are now, their detention has been sanctioned by courts, and it's expected that there will be an extradition request from Uzbek authorities for their extradition to stand trial in Uzbekistan. They've all applied for asylum here in Kazakhstan. I should mention they've all been living in Kazakhstan for many years. They have families here. We know that one of them is working as a cardiologist here. And so, there are concerns, again, with respect to non-refoulement and concerns about the possible politically motivated prosecutions they face and concerns about ill treatment and torture that could happen if extradited. So Human Rights Watch has called for them not to be forcibly returned to Uzbekistan. So it remains to be seen now what will happen with them. There is a process or a procedure that Kazakh authorities are now following in terms of what happens to people who are detained, who are wanted by another state. But we call on Kazakh officials, Kazakh government to respect the principle of non-refoulement in this case, to give careful consideration to their asylum claims and to respect international human rights law in their cases. So we're keeping a close eye on the developments. Their trial, right now it's sort of investigation stage. If they're just in detention waiting further developments in their cases, as far as I know.
Thank you. In the time we have left, I want to look at the Karakalpaks. You know, from the term, from the point of view of them being, you know, an ethnic minority in Uzbekistan. Oh, you guys have been following the region again for a long time. I certainly have too. The Karakalpaks have had complaints about their treatment for many, many years. Certainly health issues because they're located so close to the Aral Sea. But I mean, there was claims when Karimov was president that there was forced sterilization of women out there. So it's they've always felt like the ethnic Uzbek government was against them. But they're not the only group that's run into this, right? Even though you have President Mirziyoyev, to his credit, right before the protests broke out, just days before the protests came out, I think the day before, he said, "I am a son of Karakalpakstan." And to be clear, he has paid much more attention to Karakalpakstan than Karimov ever did. But are ethnic minorities treated the same? Do the Karakalpaks have a legitimate complaint when they say that we're discriminated against by the Uzbek government? And are they the only group that is discriminated against? Or is this generally the way that the Uzbek government anyway looks at minorities? Steve?
Well, no, thanks for the question, Bruce. I think it's something that, you know, these tumultuous protests for many, I think they brought into view Uzbekistan's multi-ethnic character for the first time and sort of underlined that ethnic minority issues, just like in every other country, exist in Uzbekistan. It's something we haven't paid nearly enough attention to. And what I found really interesting when I was doing research after these events is I discovered that the UN Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which is we call the CERD, actually put out recommendations, reviewed Uzbekistan's compliance with that international human rights treaty just 2 years before these events. And they criticized Uzbekistan's government for failing to collect statistics on a regular basis on all aspects of life, you know, whether it's the criminal justice system. We have no demographic or ethnographic breakdown of by ethnicity who are in prisons in Uzbekistan. We don't know enough about employment statistics. And pointedly, interestingly, at the time, the Uzbek delegation said to the UN, "Well, we don't have any complaints on file of racial discrimination." And to that, the committee said, "The absence of those complaints is not proof that there is no racial discrimination or ethnic minority discrimination in Uzbekistan." And they called on Uzbekistan to take that into account as they prepare for their census, which, by the way, there has been no census in Uzbekistan since 1989. And so I think actually these issues around Karakalpakstan in 2022, they should be a stark reminder to the Uzbek government that you can't ignore these issues. And, you know, in preparing for this census, which has been long, long awaited, and Karimov, you know, really avoided doing this, I think, to continue in many ways just the Soviet Druzhba Naroda, friendship of peoples, policy towards ethnic minorities, which was to largely sort of erode and erase many of their distinctions. But I think that's something that the Uzbek government needs to address. So it's absolutely true that ethnic minorities do face everyday discrimination. And I don't mean to say that majority ethnic Uzbeks don't face many of the same issues. But it's important that we discuss these things when it comes to Tajiks, who make up millions, and we don't know how many because there's been no census. Ethnic Tajiks in Uzbekistan often raise these issues. But again, it's very sensitive to talk about these things. We also know, obviously, about Russians, Tatars, Kyrgyz, so many other groups that have faced this. So I think these events, in a way, again, strangely to say this to the Uzbek government, but this could be, in a way, helpful for formulating a policy that actually deals with human rights and ethnic minority rights in the future, or that would be the hope.
Great. Okay, thank you. You know, and Mira, let me ask you then, and feel free to comment on any aspect of Uzbek government's policy on ethnic minorities. But, you know, to get back to Karakalpakstan a little bit, is it clear at all to what percentage of the people who were detained, do we know are actually ethnic Karakalpaks, or is that such information even available?
I am not aware of any information of that nature. I've not seen any statements to that effect. I mean, we don't even know how many people are in detention. So I think that's a good question for the authorities, and one that I hope that they will take heed of, is that they need to be more forthcoming about what's going on with the investigations, in particular, how many are under arrest, what charges individuals are facing, who it is that are being targeted with the more serious crimes committed allegedly. So, that's one for the Uzbek government to answer. Can I just add one somewhat anecdotal sort of comment about discrimination or let's say this feeling of being sort of persecuted as a Karakalpak minority? I was just talking to one of the diaspora activists here, and he noted that, even though 21 people died in the events in Karakalpakstan on July 1st and 2nd, that Uzbekistan didn't have a day of mourning. And that really, sat with me. It's true. There wasn't a sort of nationwide acknowledgement of the loss of life that happened. I think that's important for Uzbek officials to hear, is that something just as meaningful as just pausing to recognize the loss of life in Karakalpakstan and of Karakalpaks would have gone a long way in the Karakalpakstan community at large to acknowledge the suffering that took place. And the absence of that has been noticed and felt by Karakalpaks in and outside of Karakalpakstan. So it doesn't speak to discrimination, perhaps the way that you were asking earlier, but I think it is on a human level. It was a good question. Why wasn't there a day of mourning? I don't know. But something like that would have, I think, been welcomed by the Karakalpakstan community that I'm in touch with, for sure.
Okay, thanks. It is time to wrap it up. And of course, I should make clear, too, that we have been talking a little bit about the Uzbek government's treatment of ethnic minorities. They are not that much different in compared to some of the other Central Asian states and the way they treat them. It's not like Uzbekistan is the worst offender in the region or anything like that. But do you have any last comments about this topic? Mira, I'll start with you.
I think it's important to acknowledge this happened at a time, the Karakalpakstan events, the use of lethal force, the deaths and the horrific injuries took place at a time when Uzbekistan is pursuing, has stated that it's pursuing human rights and political reforms. And with that sort of reform agenda comes increased scrutiny and increased accountability. And it really is important that the Uzbek government show that it is serious about its human rights commitments, and that it's not just paying lip service when it talks about human rights, but it's actually committed to holding accountable the people that are responsible for the death and the deaths and injuries that took place in Karakalpakstan. And so, 4 months have passed. We've talked a lot about some of the problems with the investigation so far, the concerns about the violations that took place on those 2 days. And it's really now on the government to show, its partners and the international community at large that it's not just talking the talk, but that it takes, the commitments that it has taken upon itself seriously. And this is a real test. It's a real test. I'll stop there. That people are paying attention to how the outcome of the investigations that are underway, and whether or not it will lead to accountability, and whether, we can talk about Uzbekistan as a country that does take seriously its international human rights commitments, or one that just pays lip service to them.
Okay, thank you. And Steve, you get the last word.
Well, thanks, Bruce. I'd say I agree with all the due process concerns. And as Mira pointed out, Uzbekistan is on the UN Human Rights Council. It does have a responsibility to meet its obligations. And, I think initially they need to immediately release a name of the dead, the names of those who died. As Mira said, I think the lack of mourning, the lack of acknowledgement is painful for people. And I think that's, at a minimum, we need to see that a full accounting of those who lost their lives. Again, a reckoning with that, because there needs to be some consistency about that. We still don't have that final number. We need to know more about the fate of those detained, about the charges brought against them, and where those investigations are heading. I hope that the Uzbek government will respond to Human Rights Watch's calls and the calls of others to invite international experts, at least hold briefings that include international experts, discussions with the Parliamentary Commission. And again, you know, thinking about the broader, deeper issues that the UN raised 2 years ago, as Uzbekistan moves towards this census, I think the government should acknowledge the recommendations made by the UN, which included, for example, recommendations that there needs to be a guarantee of the right of education in Karakalpak language, and for that matter, other ethnic minority languages such as Tajik in Uzbekistan. And that's something that the government can do, it should do, and it should acknowledge the need to collect this type of information in prisons and education and employment. And that's, again, one way that Uzbekistan can try to not return to this type of violence. And lastly, I'll just say that the NGO decree that the government introduced in the summer, which forces independent NGOs to include government actors, government bodies in their projects, should really be disbanded. Not only does it prevent and hinder the independence of independent civil society and human rights work in Uzbekistan, but specifically, it would make it impossible for ethnic minority groups, Karakalpak organizations, for example, to do work that's independent. And that's what we need in Uzbekistan if it's truly moving towards reform, is independent civil society. So it should get rid of that NGO decree. I really hope that will be disbanded. A number of NGOs have raised it recently in public, which is very commendable and courageous. So with that, thanks for holding this conversation, Bruce.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing up that topic about the NGOs. That is also important. And, you know, thank you both. Thank you, Mira, and thank you, Steve, for being guests on the program and discussing this topic today. And a big thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.